From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. If you want to see the depth and the breadth of an actor's work, just think about what Brian Tyree Henry has done in this past year between his incredible role as James in Causeway, his unusual role as Lemon in Bullet Train, of course, I think being the soul of Atlanta as Alfred Paperboy in Atlanta. He's had quite the year, and I'm thrilled to have him here to talk to him. Brian, I'm so happy to talk to you.
Same here, man. Thank you for having me.
I just wanted to, I guess, start with Atlanta just because I do think that Paperboy does represent this kind of interesting solo show, this guy who represents sort of like id and superego in this portrayal. And I just think back to, I think, one of my favorite pieces of TV of all time, that was Barbershop. Just talk about your take on the character from the outset and how it's evolved.
Well, you know, when I was first approached with Alfred, there was an immediate connection to him. I couldn't get through the script fully because I was just so focused on how much I loved this character. Like by page five, I was already like, I know exactly who this is. You know, I went to college at Morehouse College in Atlanta. You know, that's where I started, you know, my pursuit of becoming an actor, really, you know, taking theater arts and whatnot. But it was also about my life in Atlanta and the people I came across in Atlanta. And Alfred was definitely one of those people. So when I was positioned with the opportunity to play Alfred, you know, I was incredibly excited about it because I truly felt like this was somebody that is completely misrepresented and underrepresented on television or in film. And I just wanted to make sure that I brought not just the authenticity of who Alfred is, but like the levity of who he is. You know, I mean, it's very easy to see a character that's labeled as a trap rapper and automatically put all these kind of notions of who this black man is. And I really wanted to kind of flip it on its head to where people actually cared about him, where people actually wanted to know exactly if he was going to be okay, to make sure that people saw him rise and actually rooted for him. You know, and then you have episodes like Barbershop that reflect just how people will treat you sometimes when you are on that rise of success, or how they try to keep you grounded by, in essence, kind of like, I don't know, humiliating you in their own way. It was really crazy because, you know, Atlanta, for all four of us, you know, Keith, Donald, Zazie, and myself, is kind of a reflection of our own personal trajectories in this business and in our lives, and how the relationships have shifted and how the focus has shifted, and how sometimes just because you think you've made it, it doesn't really mean anything, especially when you succeed while being black. Like, at the same time, you still have to walk into certain places with caution. You still have to have a certain awareness. You're still treated in a certain way that doesn't really reflect what you may think your status to society is as someone being notable. So Barbershop, in essence, was a testament to some of the things I've been going through, you know, like, so Alfred, you know, goes to the same barber that he's gone to since before he was famous. And this barber literally takes advantage of the fact that, oh, it's just Alfred. You know what I mean? I got to go handle this over here. I got to go do this over here. You're down, right? You're cool with it, right? So most of those emotions you see in that episode are real. Most of those reactions are real. It was a journey and a half to go through. But that's also something about Alfred's trajectory in Atlanta, right? He is kind of the lens of the audience and the lens of the people of, like, watching this absurdist novella play out in his life. You're like, what the like, why is this always happening to Alfred? I find myself asking that a lot, too. You know, with this recent season, you know, there's a few things that happened with Alfred. And I remember reading in the final season, I was like, so how many times am I getting shot at this season, you guys? Like, how many times is my life going to be in danger? And they're like, oh, you know, just a fair amount. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? Like, what is that? But I think Alfred represents that part of us that really just can see through the bullshit, you know, that really is trying to find a way to just, like, wake up in the morning and find that zen and find that peace of mind. But also, he's also that kind of guy that's like the magnetic strip that attracts that kind of craziness, right? Like, it's kind of like he's trying to navigate a world that is always throwing things his way that he didn't necessarily ask for.
I do think that Alfred and Paperboy are the soul of the show, because there's that bifurcation of what a Black man is supposed to represent and somebody living in that world of Trap as compared to who he is and how much sort of pain he's and rage he's always dealing with as Alfred and how he's wrestling with that. And it's funny, I find myself, and you probably hear this a bunch of times, thinking of Samuel Beckett whenever Alfred is the center of an episode.
I often refer to Alfred kind of like going through his own Hamlet phase, right? Like there's something kind of Shakespearean about like the detail of how he walks through life, right? There is a danger, right? There is always a sense of danger when you've chosen a certain way of life. So like, but also it's also like, what happens when that is your only recourse? What happens when all you're trying to do is really put food on the table and trying to live? How many things are often restricted to you because of that? But also, just to start at it, man, you know, he's an Atlanta native. He was born and raised in Swats, Atlanta, you know, and that's who he is. Those are the streets that he's known forever. And it's just that there's always a sense of trying to find an opportunity where there isn't one. And so what I wanted for Alfred was every opportunity to experience things. You know, that's why season 3 was so exciting, because he left Atlanta for the first time. You know, that was his first time on a plane. That was his first time in Europe. That was his first time having his own venues, you know. And then you then reflect on season 2, where you watch him actually dealing with grief and actually dealing with loss and how he plays all these things very close to his chest. And I wanted to explore those things for him to, so other people who possibly, you know, could relate to him, because I was always shocked at how many, you know, hip hop artists and rappers really thought that, you know, my depiction of him was spot on, because it's not so much about the performance, right? It really is about who they are when they lay down by themselves at night.
But so much of that too is, I mean, it's fascinating about the performative aspect of being a Black man in general, and then the performative aspect of being a hip hop artist. One of the most heartbreaking and it's funny and heartbreaking moments is that scene where he throws the money up to the crowd in Amsterdam. You kind of go, oh my God, you don't have to be him now.
But like, why not now? You know what I mean? Because by all essence, like, you know, he never thought he would reach a fan base that didn't speak English and were all white. You know what I mean? Like, so juxtapose him being in this jail that actually is the swankiest jail ever. You know, it's like a hotel. He's treated like a king for whatever it is that put him in there. And so then when he leaves and these people have been outside cheering him on and they're like having signs with his name on it, you know, and yeah, it's like, well, let's pay it forward. Let's toss him. It's a stunt. Alfred lives for the stunt. And then juxtapose that to him leaving that crowd. And then there's a Black faced child on the back of a bike. And it's like, well, then what the f- at the end of the, like, now what? You know, like there's always this kind of meteoric fall from grace that happens on our show, where there's these amazing elevated highs where you see this jubilation that goes on amongst the crew. And then all of a sudden reality smacks us right back down. And it's like, oh, well, right. We completely forgot. And so that's what I think Atlanta serves to do, especially as a Black person. It's like we are always trying to find a way to find some kind of jubilation and trying to find a way to celebrate who we are. And then at the same time, there's always a reminder of like, don't get too ahead of yourself. Like, also don't forget, like, here's the groundedness of reality. These are the circumstances if you try to do that. So I think that that's something that I love the most about playing Alfred, is because I could live so vicariously through him. I remember in season 2, I was like, Hero would ask me, you know, like, he was like, well, what really frustrates you? Like, what is something that you really want to get off your chest? I was like, I'll tell you 5 things I want to do. I was like, I want to flip a table. I want to throw a drink in somebody's face. I want to spit in somebody's face. I want to slap somebody. And then I want to throw a glass. And so in episode 8, the club, I got to do all those things like in one scene. Like, Alfred got to slap somebody with a wad of cash. And I was like, oh, there it is. We need an outlet, you know what I mean? Sometimes we need an outlet to feel like we're not just walking around steeped in rage, that we're not walking around feeling overlooked the entire time. Like, and Alfred kind of gave me a place of safety to really like let that out, you know, to really like walk through that. He protected me, you know what I mean? And so when you look at the seasons now, I'm trying my best to protect him in every way that I can. So we were kind of that shoulder to lean on for each other. He really got me through quite a bit.
We're talking about the intersection of trauma and joy, you know, the African-American life, yeah, with my guest, yeah. Brian Tyree Henry, who's starring in Causeway, but also is one of the stars of Atlanta. You can hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. First of all, what you're talking about is incredibly Shakespearean, that simultaneity of joy and trauma, one is always slightly overshadowing the other, isn't it?
Yeah, I find that they're kind of bedfellows at the same time, right? Like, it takes the same amount of muscles to smile as it does to frown, you know, like the same tears for sadness or the same tears for joy. And I'm always finding myself trying to figure out what that fine line is, because you can walk that fence and slip one side and completely succumb to one over the other. That goes into a lot of the characters that I play. And I think in essence, that's because that's who I am innately and what I've experienced in my life, because it's tough, you know, it's tough. We've been told, especially as Black men, that, you know, emotion is something that we have to hold close to the vest. Like, don't ever show that you're sad or show that, you know, you're depressed, because that in essence is a sign of weakness. And, you know, there is nothing more susceptible to pain and anguish than being seen as a weak Black man. You know what I mean? And I used to always just like scoff at that all the time, you know, because I'm a crier. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I cry. I've always been this person. And there was always this moniker of being called sensitive, as if though this was some kind of like, you know, scarlet letter that you're supposed to walk around with, you know, because of, you know, the perception of who I am. I am a broader Black man. I'm tall, I'm dark skinned. So there's all these things that are put on me that I'm not supposed to be, that I'm not supposed to show. The different ways I've been told not to do things is one thing, and what I can't do. And, you know, you get tired of that. You get tired of that. And I had to fight very hard for most of my life to not believe it. You know, I was like, well, what are all the things I can do? Why aren't those things readily available to be told to me of what I can actually aspire to be and feel? And then I realized that I shouldn't wait on anybody else to tell me how to feel. I shouldn't wait on anybody else to describe what my healing looks like, to describe what my joy and my pain looks like. It's mine. So therefore, I tend to pick characters that give me a chance to do that, or characters that I feel need that. And Alfred and James in tandem were definitely two that I felt needed that the most.
The reason I say that, I think Alfred is the soul of the show, because we can see he's wrestling with these two things in a way the other characters don't have to, you know, because there is this persona and this idea that, you know, if you're a hip hop artist, you ridicule weakness. I mean, still in the 21st century,
yeah,
and hip hop still does that. And so him wrestling with this and all this sort of rage and anger are so much a part of him. And all these things you're talking about that he will let you do in that episode. First of all, it felt like a Lost 3-6 Mafia video. But also, it felt like all these things that Alfred would never get to do, he's going to do.
You know, there's this thing that we do as Black people where we cover our scars so amazingly. We're able to drape ourselves in the finest things. We're able to act and walk as if though everything is okay. And it's a gift. The problem with that is that at the end of the day, when you disrobe, the scars are so visible that there's nowhere to run. You know what I mean? Like, we never think about what it's like, or not us, rather, what other people think. They never think that we are susceptible to pain. You know what I mean? Like, for some reason, there's this thing of like people thinking that everything's going to be all right. And, you know, if we at least cover this scar and do this, but we never think about the actual healing of the scar. You never think about what it's like to like let the light shine through the cracks in the veneer that we've held so long. And I think when I act, that's where I kind of want all the cracks to show. When I'm able, as Brian, to walk through and try to act like I'm so pulled together, when I'm able to step into the shoes of these Black men that I play, I want to lean into the cracks more. I want to lean into the exposure of said scars, because that's the only way that I think a viewer can honestly relate to what he's going through and who he is, and actually wanting him to make it to the other side. And look, this is generational, you know. I come from, you know, my father, he's a Vietnam vet, you know. He was born in 1940. He was raised in Jim Crow South. He dealt with all kinds of things that I will never be able to understand. But I think for me, having this opportunity to display these men that I think he encountered in his life, or these men that, you know, that represent a part of him, it really does help with the healing process, I think, of trying to understand what it's like to generationally get over, what it's like to truly try to elevate, but without forgetting exactly where you come from.
It's this treatment. We're talking about survival as an aesthetic with my guest, Brian Tyree Henry. He's one of the stars of Course of Atlanta and starring in the new film, Causeway. We'll take a break. You can hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. There's more to come. Welcome back. It's therapy session. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's the treat, my guest.
Yes.
The volleyball and extremely talented Brian Tyree Henry. We can see him in Atlanta, of course. His Emmy-nominated performance. He's a Tony-nominated for the terrific show, Lobby Hero. He's also starring in Causeway with Jennifer Lawrence. And you were talking about protecting and wanting to protect Alfred. And as James, that side of you comes across. And one of my favorite things you've ever done is a scene where you're asleep in the car. We should say that it's really a film about wounds that both veterans and others can feel and how they heal each other from those wounds. And you're playing a close friend of an Afghanistan veteran. That scene when you fall asleep in the car is so much about not only releasing yourself, but also protecting her by basically showing confidence in her. And I thought that was an extraordinary, extraordinary scene. It lends itself into what we're talking about, doesn't it?
There is this point in the movie where you see James kind of drop everything and reveal his comfort zone, right? Like the big trauma he experienced was him driving a car and it caused someone to lose their life. The ability to drop that curtain and really just be okay to fall asleep with someone else driving your car, to allow someone into your home that you probably haven't allowed anyone into, or no one has ever even asked to come and see where you live, to really just sit down and share a beer with somebody in this empty space, this quiet space that was once filled with life, this big space where you used to be able to walk on both feet and now you don't. There was something that I think that Jen and Lila and I, we peeled back the layers of that onion to really see that we needed to see James. We needed to see where he came from. We needed to see, you know, what really mattered to him rather than him being a character that pops in and pops out. And that's not what we wanted. I was like, we have to show the true humanity of him, because then only then can we really connect to the losses that he went through. And then we can also want and champion for his wins and champion for his healing. So it was really cool to see that part, because you in that scene, which is a connection of a broader scene, which is like we go out for a burger, you know, and then we walk down the street and share a smoke, and then we end up in the park, and then we, you know, and I was like, oh, the building of an actual friendship, the building of an actual connection. When is the last time James even had that? You know, like I would mention to Jen and Lila, I was like, if she's going to therapy for her disability, then that means James knows all those doctors. That means James knows all the people she's going to. And that also means that everyone in that town knows what he lost. I'm sure it was in the paper. I'm sure everyone was at the funeral. I'm sure everyone, you know, he works at an auto body shop. I'm sure his auto body shop got the wreckage of the car after, you know. So those are the things that I kind of wanted to say, but to have the ability to show without saying anything. You know, there was always this weight that I felt was on James that nobody cared to see. You know, and I think that when he meets Lindsay, you see that veneer crack wide open, especially when you see him asleep in the passenger side of his car. Like, I think he's always been the driver, right? He's always been the guy behind the wheel. And now he actually met someone who is willing to drive him home, who is willing to let him sleep, who is willing to come inside and see his home and share a beer with him. And I think in the essence of trauma and the essence of loss, I think that's all we really want at the end of the day, is someone to treat us human again and someone to actually go, hey, you know what? I see you, and you can drop all that because it doesn't serve you anymore.
We can feel oftentimes James' discomfort being inside, being indoors. And so when he's finally in that house with her, he's a different person. His body language is different. And I want you to talk about that, because it's an interesting way to sort of play something that you're not going to articulate verbally, but it's definitely there. I mean, I was thinking about that scene in that bar, but just the way his back tenses up, you can see when he's indoors. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, when we were making this scene, I was like, well, this to me was the truest intimacy, right? Because now you, as the audience, are with Lindsay at the same time going into James's home for the first time. And there were a lot of things that I was like, well, what's going to happen? I mean, like, you can see there's no ramp. You can see crutches in the background and a cane, but you know he's not using them. You can see that the walls are pretty bare. I always feel like when you invite somebody into your home, you're kind of inviting them into your soul, right? Like your home is your place of safety and shelter. And it's also an essence of your style and your taste and who you are and the places you've been and the things you've accumulated over time. And sometimes our homes become our prisons. And I think that for James, for the most part, you kind of see the machinations of his mind and his grief the minute that he stumbles up his own stairs. You know what I mean? The minute that he goes to the fridge and offer her a beer, where he sits, how he puts his leg up, and also that he's inebriated. You know, like I was saying, I bet that this is a place where he is always inebriated. And then you also hear him making this plea to someone to be like, please move in. Like, let's be friends. Let's smoke in the morning. Let's make coffee. Like, it's a plea, because I think that he has made his home his own personal prison. And I think that he felt like he deserved that. There's a stillness that happens in that scene that resonates with me, because I often think about myself and how most of my life was me running away from what I was told was home and running away to try to find a home all the time. Like, that's like my MO. Like, I'm the runaway kid. It's just like, I can never really settle. I still wear my shoes indoors.
Wait a second. Why were you running away from what you perceive to be a home? You can't just drop that and then keep walking with the shoes on.
You know, it was hard. It was hard. My familial unit was a little fractured. I was living with my father, who, like I said, is a Vietnam vet, and things were rough. You know, they were a little rough. And so I found solace with other homes. Like, you know, if I wanted to celebrate holidays, I would go down the block and be there. If I wanted to celebrate my birthday, I would go to another home and be there. When I got to college, I ran away to that. When I got to grad school, I ran away to that. Once I graduated grad school, I ran to New York and found solace in theater. So it was always an essence of finding home. I used to do this thing of making sure that everyone thought I was okay, as long as they never knew where I lived. Like, you know, when I was raised in D.C., you know, I moved every year with my mother. You know, we had to move every year. So there was never an essence of actually being able to be comfortable and making a place a home. And I feel like I wanted to kind of release that in this film, honestly, when we shot the home scenes for James, because I think that he had been yearning for someone to ask to drive him home. I think he's always been paying penance for what he's done and feeling like he deserved to be alone and feeling like he deserved to not have anybody be there in his home or to share space with. And I could relate to that.
Wow, it's a treatment. You can also hear kcrw.com/a treatment. And we're talking to Brian Tyree Henry, who does a terrific job in the new film Causeway. That entire night, each successive scene is a further lowering of his guard until he lets her into this home, this place that's not a home, like I was saying, and you were saying too, and where he actually tortures himself to get in. He won't even make it comfortable for him to enter his house. By that point, when he's just sort of brick by brick lowering his reserve and saying, in effect, to her, it's okay to feel the way you feel too, because this is how I feel. I mean, not only is he like letting her into his home, and offering her a kind of, you know, shade and the heat and protection from what she's feeling, he's also saying to himself, too, it's okay for me to admit this to somebody. We're talking about the performative aspect of being Black and the kind of strength that you have to show all the time, and this kind of strength that he's always shown, and that he's sitting down when he's saying these things to her instead of standing. And we can also see how uncomfortable he is all the time he's standing. So we can always feel that discomfort because he's making himself suffer by not, by standing on his own 2 feet, whether they be 2 feeling feet or not. So all these things are sort of compacted into that, aren't they?
Yeah, for sure. There's a thing that happens, I believe, with most amputees called the phantom limb, right? Or phantom limb syndrome, where you have lost a part of yourself that you, in essence, for a while, feel like it's still there. You wake up and think that it's there. You constantly keep moving and trying to work around this missing limb. And I felt like the phantom limb isn't just about his leg, but about his grief as well. Grief is tricky, and grief is as long a journey as you want it to be, but it's still a journey nonetheless. And so I just kept relating the phantom limb for James, not just to him losing his leg, but to the losses in his life and the relationships that are no longer there and how he can't really navigate that. I also thought about just like the kind of tortured soul he made himself to be, because it's like, as a runaway kid myself, if something goes off that I don't like, I'm out. You know, like if I'm like, oh, well, this place doesn't serve me anymore, I'm going to go. He chose to stay. You know, he chose to stay in the same place. He chose to stay in the same job. He chose to stay in the same house. That's also like ironic that if he wanted to run away, he really can't, you know? I just wanted to figure out what that is about those people who make decisions like that. I think about people who have lost a loved one or their wife or husband, right, or their child, and then they keep the houses that they lived in or those people once occupied the same way. How they change the sheets to the bed or they don't change the sheets to the bed, and they keep the room kind of like as a mausoleum to these people and to their grief and what that is. The fact that James was in a terrible car accident and works at an auto body shop repairing cars for other people. You know, like, I was really interested in what that must feel like for someone, and not so much what it feels like, but how to show that, you know, what that means. And I just want to jump to, like, the pool scene, for example. You know, like, you know, New Orleans is hot. And I bet that he's never, like, been in a personal pool. You know, like, I'm sure that he's never even thought about that. And so when this, you know, his friend offers him the option to get in this pool, I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, well, what is that going to be? Because now he has to literally expose himself in more ways than one. He has to literally, like, take his leg off and, like, really, like, just release that self-consciousness about it, because, you know, he wants to find salvation in this pool, you know, and get in the pool. Like, those things brought about a lot of anxiety, you know, because I was like, wow, like, I never thought about that, like, what it must be like to just have to take your leg off in front of someone in order to get some kind of release by, like, something simple as swimming. I always refer to that scene as the baptism scene, just because it's a moment that both of us are, you know, basically down to the bare minimum, and we are submerged in this water, and we're laying everything out in the open. We're experiencing joy at the same time. We're releasing those burdens that we had carried all the way up through, you know, the film, where it's a place where you actually see them in this jovialness. And then something happens where, you know, the reality sets in and all these truths are confronted and laid out. And there's no going back. You know, there's now that it's out there, there's no going back. Playing James was very meaningful for me, an incredible part of my healing process as well, because I cared about him. And I didn't want people to feel bad for him. You know what I mean? He even says that. He's like, I got enough people feeling bad for me. What he just wanted to have is the recognition that someone understands and that someone notices and that someone takes a minute to ask if he's okay. I think that is truly what I wanted at the end of the day, was just a connection. So I didn't have to, you know, roll my grief up a hill like Sisyphus. You know, I really wanted to feel like someone saw me. And I think that, in essence, is what James needed and wanted too.
My guest, who clearly is a very healthy, emotional person, is Ryan Tyree Henry. He's having an incredible year. We can see him now in the film Causeway. I can't thank you enough. And please, you have to come do the show again, will you?
Oh, I would love to, Elvis, man. Anytime. Anytime.
It's been quite the year for Brian Tyree Henry. The final season of the FX series Atlanta, a starring role in the Brad Pitt action comedy Bullet Train, and now he's co-starring with Jennifer Lawrence in the new film Causeway. There's more talk of transformational magic with past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com/The Treatment. There's always magic here. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, Paul Feig, is, unlike the rest of us during the pandemic, managed to keep very, very busy. He's had two TV shows on, Welcome to Fletch and Minx, and managed to make a movie, The School for Good and Evil, forgive my imprecision there, and to write a book, Cocktail Time, Great Advice, Embarrassing Stories, and 125 Classic and Original Drinks. So, of course, we're talking to my fellow Detroiter and the best dressed man on radio right now, Paul Feig. Paul, thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis. Always good to be here.
You know, it's interesting because in reading the chapter of the book, How to Make Sure Everybody Has Fun, including you, it's basically your philosophy of directing a film, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm a fan of parties, and I want people to have as much fun as possible and be their best selves on a movie set and be their best selves, you know, talent-wise, and at a party just to be their best selves as fun people.
But it's also about, too, keeping an eye on everything, which is, I know, your interest. Whenever I'm with you, you're always aware of what's going on in the room around us, and you can take the temperature of the room. And that's something I wonder where that came from. Is it just an affinity you've always had? Is it something that got built up for you?
I'm just fascinated with the world around me. I guess it comes from having been an only child a little bit. So, you know, you spend a lot of time on your own. So you're just kind of taking everything in, weirdly, you know, but also just in what I do, you know, getting to be a filmmaker and a storyteller and all that. It's so much about people, and it's about looking for inspiration and observing things, either how people interact or how they look or how they dress or how a room looks. I'm fascinated by everything. I mean, that's why lockdown was so hard for, you know, somebody like myself and for most of us. Is, you know, you're not getting any outside stimulation other than, you know, what you can watch on TV. But, you know, I just want to be out in the world and seeing everything.
Again, I was so fascinated to read that chapter. I just thought this really is, in a lot of ways, I felt there's a lot of conversations that we had just about making sure everything, the atmosphere is right. The ambience is there to create this thing to get people into being, as you said, their best selves, making sure the music is right, not too loud, making sure that you put the right people together in the right situations, but also trying to make room for a little bit of that, what you hope is inevitable chemistry by putting this group of people together. It really is a template for making a movie.
You know, I feel that like people don't know how to throw parties anymore, you know, not like it used to be such kind of an art form. You know, when you look at, you know, those pictures from the 50s and the 60s of like Truman Capote throwing parties I love those pictures of like old New York parties in people's apartments and they're wearing black tie and gowns. You know, and they're having interesting conversations. And you read the guest list and it was authors and, you know, doctors and like this mix of people, you know, and in London, where I live part time, we've got some friends, especially this woman, Kathy Lett, who's a great Australian novelist. She throws these parties that are the craziest mix of everybody, of, you know, like doctors, scientists, poets, actors, you know, just, you know, people from other industries you wouldn't even kind of think about or interact with normally. And it's just, it's wonderful, you know, it's just like with a movie. I mean, you're putting a party together and making a party go is like being in the editing room, kind of structuring a film, because kind of have good opening, pulls people in, got to keep people interested throughout it. And, you know, and sometimes the score comes in and drives of the party, sometimes it goes down, you know, so the party starts to flag, you put some music on or the conversation gets good, then you pull the music back, you know, and then you work towards a great third act.
Well, it's the treatment. My guest, who probably doesn't want to throw a Truman Capote party because then nobody would be speaking to anybody else by the time it's over, is Paul Feig. His terrific book is Cocktail Time. He also has a terrific new movie, The School for Good and Evil, which we'll get into. So much about what you do is making sure that people understand who they are. And your movies are about people who don't understand who they are. And I think there's that sort of interesting schism between the two of them.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that because I just, you know, I feel like none of us really kind of ever feel we quite know who we are. And we spend definitely the first half of our lives, at least, just desperately trying to figure that out and making mistakes and becoming the person we're not, or trying to become the person we're not. And I have such great sympathy for that, having been through it. And I still go through it. I mean, now that I just turned 60, you know, you'd hope you're kind of at least have some sort of clue of what you do and who you are. But even that changes constantly because you get different things you want to do and you meet different people and get inspired by different things, but it's that being open to it that makes us who we are. But I have great sympathy and feel really bad for people who aren't able to take shots at figuring out who they are and come close to discovering the parts of themselves that mean the most to them and to their happiness, if that makes any sense.
No, of course it does. Because I was thinking about this in terms of School for Good and Evil, that opening sequence, which gives you a chance to do something I'm sure you've always wanted to do, have a swashbuckling fight. But it's also about two brothers who clearly don't really know each other. And it's a great way to start it. And that's not the book, by the way.
No. That actually was a scene that we shot after we had kind of finished primary production, because, you know, we were introducing this villain kind of, you know, a third of the way into the movie, and nobody had any idea who the heck he was. And you didn't kind of invest in this guy. But, you know, the whole idea that this school was started by these two brothers, one good, one evil, you know, it was so fascinating to us that we really wanted to explore that more. And, you know, and then having the great Kit Young playing both roles made it even more fun for that.
But no, again, just, and I don't want to give too much of the movie away, but just this kind of shock of one discovering that his brother isn't what he thought he was is really a compelling and interesting way to sort of start this story about people coming into their own and having to figure out who they are too.
The books that Soman Chandani wrote are really fascinating because he really, in a very, you know, YA fun way, explores a lot of these themes of you know, who we are and do we really know who the people we know are, you know, and do we truly know who ourselves are, you know? And that's what I love about, that's what drew me to the movie in general, just the whole idea that, you know, it seems so relevant today when the world is so broken down to I'm good, you're evil, you know, what you believe is terrible, what I believe is right. The idea of getting to go in and go like, look, we're all a lot of different things and some parts of us are bad and some parts are good, but you know, we're a mix. It's all gray area. And, you know, I think that's a great lesson to be able to put across, not only to, you know, to younger audiences, but to older audiences. I think honestly, older audiences are the ones these days that need that message more than anybody.
It's funny too, because I thought it's an interesting way to start off a movie that's based on YA material, because having written this kind of stuff yourself, adults need kind of a point of entry. And that gives adults a point of entry, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, really. It really does. Because, you know, if you kind of ease into it like a Disney film, even if you're kind of having fun with that, because we have this, you know, kind of the scene after that, we come into this, what turns out to be a dream sequence of this beautiful ball that's very, you know, reminiscent of like Beauty and the Beast and all that. It does just sort of age you down immediately. And I never made this movie to be a kid's movie. That was all, you know, when I first talked to Scott Stuber about it at Netflix way back when, you know, it was like, he was like, you know, this should be the anti-Disney movie. I was like, oh, I 100% agree. So you got to shoot a movie out of a cannon, you know, when you start it. You just got to kind of get something that grabs people, especially when you're making a movie for streaming, which only kind of dawned on me as I was sort of in the middle of putting this whole movie together, which is, oh my gosh, this
really?
Is a, like, well, yeah, like in a movie theater, unless people are really, really, you know, impatient, you got a good 10 to 20 minutes for them to, you know, if you really blow it, then they'll go like, ah, I'm leaving, I'm out of here. But on streaming, like within 10 seconds, they can go like, nah, I don't like the look of this and turn it off. So that is terrifying as a filmmaker, but it sure makes you go, all right, man, let's get this party started as fast as we can.
Really? Because I feel like your movies always, I mean, Bridesmaids comes out of a cannon, you know? I mean, it hits you pretty fast.
Yeah.
Or Spy, you know, I mean, any of your last few films, they get going really quickly. So to hear that this was an added consideration is kind of shocking to me.
Well, it was because I, you know, I've always had this theory about, yeah, definitely start them fast. But in those situations, more like, oh, this is going to be my choice to start it with a big blast out front in the movie theaters. Because again, you know, you get that 10 to 20 minutes, I think. But for streaming, it was kind of like, oh gosh, like, I'm glad that's how I always think, because now I've even got to push it further. You know, we just kind of rolled slowly into this. I don't have a lot of faith with a movie like this that kind of presents itself as being a bigger movie that's going to have a lot of, you know, stuff to look at in it, that if we kind of tiptoed in, I'm not that confident in my filmmaking to go like, okay, let's just kind of have a nice quiet opening. Plus, what fun is that, Elvis? Come on.
If anybody knows fun, it's you. But even Welcome to Flesh, I mean, you treat comedy as a sink or swim proposition.
Well, it is, you know, I mean, honestly, you know, audiences, even though they come to comedy wanting to have a good time, I think they bring a lot of hostility to it. I see it all the time. I've seen over the years with my movies, you know, my more kind of straightforward comedies. When you put out a trailer, you'd get this almost hostile reaction, like online, of like, oh, well, clearly all the best jokes are in the trailer. You know, and you're like, whoa, let's slow down. Like, we're not here trying to fool you, you know. But then I kind of go, well, maybe people have been burned by enough comedies that sort of didn't work. They don't want to get swindled into it.
It's partially too, just because you want to create a shock for the protagonist so often, because that second scene you're talking about, which is also a cocktail party, by the way. But I think that idea of getting back to dislocation, so the audiences feel as I think sort of discombobulated as your protagonists do. Is that a conscious thing for you?
Yeah, it is. It is. You want to, you know, well, you want your characters to kind of be like, well, I got to figure this out, or I got to figure out who I am, or I got to figure out what's going on. I got to figure something out, you know, because that's really storytelling at its base, is somebody going, we got to figure this out. It's usually the audience, like, figure out what's going on and get invested in it. I think it's just good for everybody to kind of get knocked sideways right out of the gate. You want to set the characters and you want to know what the ground rules are. And usually that classic screenplay storytelling structure, the first act, which is basically your first half hour, is kind of getting to know everybody, getting to know what they do, all that. And then at the end of the first act, you've got your plot point one, if you want to go back to your Sid Field book, and that's where the inciting incident happened that knocks everything on the sideways. But it's funny, when you watch movies from even from like the 70s and the 80s, I'm always kind of amazed at like how slowly they could start. And I don't say it's a bad thing, but it's just, you almost go like, wow, I don't know if audiences would go along for the ride in the same way unless they were just really set up to go, something's going to happen, I can't wait to find out what's going to happen.
And just watching a bunch of stuff to get ready for this, more often than not, for your protagonist has this kind of like, what's going on? Look on their faces. And this movie actually starts with that. And I just thought that is a really compelling way to get audiences to pay attention and to invest, because just that struggle between those two brothers and the presumably good brother, you're going, wait, who are you? I just thought that really was a really interesting way to pique an audience's attention.
It's just, how do you pull people into a story? Most of my movies, and School for Good and Evil doesn't quite hold up in this way of being, are point of view movies. It's always, you're always with the lead character. I'm never a fan of sort of eye of God storytelling, or let's go over here and find out what they know. Let's go over here and find out what they know, if I can avoid it. I mean, this story is so much about these two young women who get dropped in these two schools. You got to check between the two of them. But in general, it's just, once you're in one person's point of view, then I think it's more compelling as an audience, because just like in life, we're like, what's going to happen next? What's around me? What's coming down the pike? What's around the corner? I'd rather that than go like, that person comes around the corner, they're going to find this person. Okay, now let's go back to them and watch how they react when they see the thing that we already know is going to happen. I just think it's just much more fun storytelling to never get outside of that character's head, to let the audience be that lead character.
I always love your books, just because, having read a few of them now, because you actually do that thing you were talking about, which is you give the reader time to sort of get acclimated rather than rushing them into it. And I just think we really are touching on these two poles of your sensibility here. I mean, the book really sort of explains to people basically what a cocktail is, but explaining in a way is like, I know this, you should too.
The funny thing about a book that flies in the face of how I make my movies is, a book is like a movie that you could drop in the middle of if you wanted to before you watched anything else, So weirdly, it's not a novel. This is a book of, it's filled with party advice and recipes and then doofy stories from my life and all that. But it's got pictures and drawings and all that stuff. And so when you pick up a book, the first thing you do is go to the middle of the book, and kind of flip through it and look at all the stuff. For me, it takes away the pressure of like, oh man, I really gotta ease them in or bring them in somehow, because nobody's gonna open a book to the first page of a book that's a book basically of recipes and party planning advice with a lot of really stupid stories from my life put in there too. But it's nice. It's that's why like writing a book while you're writing a screenplay or in the middle of production or developing or whatever, it's so nice, because like the weird precision you have to have when you're putting a script together or developing a script, which is all about economy of everything. What's the shortest way I can tell this? What's the quickest way I can tell this? What's the latest I can get into this scene? When's the earliest I can get out of this scene? To then go into now I'm going to work on the book in the afternoon. And it's just like, I'm just going to take my time and tell these stories. Clearly don't be boring. But at the same time, you can kind of unspool a little bit differently. And it was really nice. That's the first time I've ever done a book that you don't have to read in a linear fashion. You can pop around. You always hope people will, and you structure it so that if they do that, they will have what I consider to be a good time, but they don't have to. And there's something kind of great about that.
It's the treatment. My guest who's made me feel remiss by starting his book at the beginning is Paul Feig. The book is Cocktail Time. His new movie for Netflix is School for Good and Evil. But this other thing, this linkage that clearly all these projects make clear, is so often your projects and even the book start with somebody who's sort of special in a way that they don't recognize. Mm. And that, in fact, nobody around them recognizes. There's a fairy tale aspect to this that took me back to Ignatius almost. But just the way you structure that person who doesn't recognize, we're talking about not knowing yourself, but also we go to the heat and what Sandra Bullock has to come to recognize about herself, not recognizing who and what they are. And I wonder where that comes from. Because that's again, it really is this thing that lends itself to telling a YA story, obviously. But also, there is a real kind of fable aspect to all of this.
I relate to that the most of somebody who doesn't know who they are. And we talked about that a little earlier. But it's always the hope that you are the chosen one, you know, that you are special and you don't know it, you know, and that everybody around you doesn't know it and treats you terribly because of it. And I think it, you know, for me, it always kind of came from being bullied, you know, because I had some pretty aggressive bullies throughout my school career. You know, I had a lot of friends and I was the funny guy, but there was always the people who didn't buy into it so much that they wanted to take you down for it. Or I was also a tall kid and, you know, all my bullies were short. And so I was like, you know, Goliath, and they were, you know, these low rent Davids trying to take me down, even though I would never fight anybody. So it was really, you know, jokes on them. But, you know, but you would kind of walk around and go, they don't know what I could do. They, you know, but then you don't know if you have the confidence to know what you could do either. But deep down, you feel like you have it. And it's that constant yin and yang between, do I have the confidence to try to be what I think I can be? Or what if I try to be what I think I can be and I'm not and I fail? I think that drives us so much. And a lot of people, sadly, don't muster up that confidence to go for what they think they could be. It doesn't always mean that you are what you think you could be, but in going for it, it allows you to then pivot and go, I thought it could be this, but actually I might be a little more this, but it's in more of a direction of what I wanted to do than, you know, what I'm, you know, stuck doing, you know, for people who kind of get trapped in doing something that they, you know, would rather not be doing.
So often in the movies too, there's a kind of a glamour that someone has that these protagonists aspire to, simple plan. I mean, this seeming confidence that somebody else that they see has that they want.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the trappings of confidence throw everybody off. I mean, come on, social media is all social media is based on is like, oh, their life's so much better than mine. Look at how glamorous they look. Look how cool they are. Look at all the cool stuff they're doing, you know, and it is a smokescreen, but it's also aspirational. I don't think it's, you know, I don't say it kind of like, oh, you know, social media is so terrible, because I don't think there's anything bad about being inspired by things, by seeing, you know, whether it's things that people have that they got through what hopefully is their talent, you know, but, or if it just go like, oh, that stuff, you know, if I could be more successful by doing what I think I would be the best at, I could have that stuff too. And that sounds kind of bougie, really, you know, but at the same time, there's something nice to be driven to aspire to an image and the trappings of that image. You know, I think you need that to kind of move yourself forward. Or if it's just the aspiration is I could be such a better person, I could be such a good person, when you're seeing people doing wonderful things, whatever inspires you to be the better version of yourself and not be a total jerk to everybody while you're doing on your way there. And once you get there, I mean, that's the other caveat is, you know, don't be insufferable. But yeah, I just think you want to be inspired to keep moving forward and to keep bettering yourself.
A really wonderful thing at the very back of Cocktail Time, Nice Things to Do with Your Money, which has a list of charities that go from the Black Visions Collective to UNICEF. And it's a really beautiful note just to sort of say you can extend the generosity of a cocktail party and the spirit of generosity from which that comes to your entire life.
Oh, thanks. No, you know, I mean, that came from when, you know, when I started that Instagram show, which basically right at the very beginning of the pandemic, I came back from North Carolina where we were shooting a Flatch because we had to shut down, and just kind of said, we're going to be locked away for months, it seems like. What can I do to help? And so I thought, well, you know, I'll try to entertain people. So I'll do this cocktail show, you know, I'll learn how to make cocktails, but it has to be for something. And so we made a point of every single day, we did 100 days in a row without taking a break, and had a new charity every day that was, you know, started out for first responders. And then when Black Lives Matter happened, it pivoted into that, you know, and so it was just really nice to every day get to find a new charity, and vet that new charity and then be able to tell people, to, you know, we're trying to raise money for it and then myself to give money to it. So I definitely wanted to carry that forward into the book because, you know, it is just so important to support all these organizations.
Again, this is fascinating to me how much of your life in so many ways this book happens to include, even though it's about what people would consider to be presumably a frivolous subject.
Well, I mean, it's probably even more than my memoirs. It's probably my most personal book because it's so much about stuff that I'm really into. And I didn't even realize how much things like, this sounds really bad, how much things like cocktails drive my life. And I don't mean it like kind of a drunk guy way. I mean it more in the idea of what represents to me being an adult, being a grown-up, being somebody who is kind of moving forward and figuring out their life. And it sounds weird to equate that all to cocktails, so stick with me on this. But it's, you know, there's so much arrested development mentality in this world, you know, especially for the last number of decades. And I think it comes from, you know, the patriarchy was always so bad and so inflexible. And we, you know, those older of us, you know, grew up with really, you know, I didn't have a tough father, but you grew up around a lot of tough men. And it was very, you know, patriarchal in that way. And so everything since then, since like, you know, the 60s on, has been this real like rebellion against adulthood. And I find that really sad because I don't want to be a teenager. You know, I don't want to be a kid. When I was a kid, I didn't want to be a kid. I would watch Darren on Bewitched come home, you know, and mix a martini. And I was like, that looks cool to me like that. And that guy is successful. And he's, you know, he's got a beautiful wife who happens to be a witch who could do magic. So that's cool. But I found that really fun. So I think it's so wrapped up for me in cocktail culture because cocktail culture is not for kids. It's not even for teenagers. You know, it's for adults. You know, it's like when you go to a restaurant, there's a table full of kids, you know, and you're kind of like, okay, fair enough. But at the same time, you're like, is this like the adult place where I don't have to listen to kids playing on their iPads and all that, you know? So I just want that separation between here is something for grownups. This is for adults. That's what cocktail time's all about.
Well, I never thought I'd live long enough to hear somebody say Darren Stevens was his raison d'être, but it happened. It's Paul Feig. His new book is Cocktail Time. It's terrific and a great gift to give, obviously. His new film is also very giftful, I think, is The School for Good and Evil, writer-director Paul Feig. Paul, always great to talk to you. Thanks for doing this.
Elvis, you are the best. Thank you, my friend.
Director, writer, and cocktail enthusiast Paul Feig, whose current wealth of projects include Cocktail Time, A Guide to Grown-Up Fun, and his Netflix film, The School for Good and Evil. Of course, you can find previous chats with Paul Feig and other interviews at kcrw.com/thetreatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. And with The Treat, writer, director, and author Rebecca Miller on a play so ahead of its time that it still makes a demand on our imaginations.
I'm Rebecca Miller, and this is The Treat. The play The Cherry Orchard by Anton Chekhov, which I was actually in as the character of Anya in a production directed by Peter Brook many years ago, actually. It's just a masterpiece of a play that I adore, and it involves a family who comes back to their ancestral home and they kind of try and inhabit it, and they realize that they kind of try and come back to the past that they've abandoned because of tragedy. And they really can't. And they have to embrace the future. They're sort of forced to embrace the future. It's heartbreaking because of the levels of nostalgia. And it's also very funny. Anya, which was the character I played, really starts as a child. She's kind of a little, like a cherished, slightly spoiled, but well-meaning child And then by the end of it, she's somebody who wants to be a part of a new future in her country, and she's politicized and she's sort of grown up and realized that she can't really still be her mother's little girl, and like she's changed in certain ways. Anya really does change, but she doesn't change in an obvious way, in the way she talks, the way she moves, and the way she sort of is in the world. It hasn't really changed that much, but you realize that she suffered, and through suffering, she's been transformed. That's the good side of suffering, I guess, that it, you know, which is part of life. And it's certainly, without suffering, fiction would not be very interesting. Chekhov perfectly balances darkness and lightness. And you can be crying one minute, and the next minute, you know, you're laughing. And that's really what life is like. I mean, I think in a way, he's the guy that got it right.
The treat from the multi-talented Rebecca Miller, whose new project is Total, a short story collection. Check out past editions of The Treat, such as Ethan Hawke on his particular theatrical immersion. The Treat features talents that shape the culture from film to fashion, from music to graphic novels, on the cultural moments that shape that. Rebecca Mooney produces and edits the show. It's mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Thanks this week to Anna Buss and Laura Kandarajan for their help. I'm Elvis Mitchell. To better days, everybody, it's The Treatment.